Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Welcome to Life's a Beach. I'm Bruce Hopkins, better known as Hoppo from Bondi Rescue. Each week I'll be sharing some stories, the good, the bad, and everything in between. I'll be chatting to guests about their life experiences and giving our listeners an insight to the challenges we have faced in our lives. We'll share a few jokes and some banter along the way, and hopefully our experiences will resonate with you. As the saying goes, while life's a beach, it can also be a bitch.
Hey everyone, this week on Life's a Beach, I have Australia's own R&B soul songstress in the beach shack. Her name is Prinny Stevens, and I've known her for a fair while and also been to some of her concerts. Now, she talks about growing up on the northern beaches, her singing, her dancing, and also acting. It's an amazing story, and some of the musicals that she has worked on is astonishing. So let's sit back and have a listen to my chat with Prinny. Okay, this week in the beach shack, it's a pleasure to have Prinny Stevens. Now, she's had a magnificent career singing and also acting as well, so dancing, a whole range of things. So welcome, Prinny, into the beach shack.
I'm very excited. We're pretty close to each other, but you know, it's good to be online and see your handsome face this early in the morning.
Well, Prinny, let's go back to when you grew up in the northern beaches. So tell us a bit about when you were growing up.
It's funny because like I live northern beaches, and anyone who knows anything about, well, actually any beaches really, the locals are pretty full on. And anyone that doesn't know, they're like, oh, so how long have you been here? And I'm like, been here my whole life. And I really have. Like, I still live on the same street where the primary school is that I grew up, high school. Everything is so central for me. You know, back in the 80s when I was growing up, it was a very different place. It almost wasn't a cool place to be. It was far more like, it wasn't as affluent as it is now, I guess. Like, it's like the trendy place now, whereas back in the day, it really wasn't. Nobody really looked like me. I think about my mum, who's like, she came from Tonga in her 20s, late 20s, and on the beaches, and very, very, you know, accent, the whole thing. So, but I grew up, my older brother was a surfer, so grew up around Narrabeen when the like Rip Curl Challenge was on, and I was around like Poto and Tavita David and all these. My older brother was on the circuit with like Nathan, Damien Hardman, all those lived on my same street. So I grew up in that kind of culture, and the surf culture is pretty hardcore. Anyone who knows it, it's pretty hardcore. But I guess that's how I grew up, but then somehow ended up in music, which I didn't see on the beaches. Like, no one looked like me or had the same aspirations that I did. My older brother kind of went with, you know, he was a surfer on the beaches. Like, that wasn't different. He looked different, but it wasn't a different choice. But for me, wanting to be a singer was like, you want to do what? Like, and go to that place called the city. What's that? So, yeah, and I started really young. So I started like singing in the clubs when I was like 14. My mum would take me. she'd hold my hand the whole time. Yeah, it was always a commute into the city. I still live on the beaches, so it's still where my heart is, but it's definitely changed over the years, as all the kind of beach areas have. So, yeah.
And do you find, as you said, you look different. Did you find that difficult? Did people treat you different to what you expected?
Yeah, but, you know, ignorance is bliss. Like when I was growing up, I didn't really get the full thing. I definitely knocked out Brad Wood and you too for calling me a piece of poo. But, like, that was just me reacting. But you don't really get it. Like I think back now and I'm like, far out. We would have been the only islanders. Although there was quite a fair few Tongan and Polynesian women that went to a nursing school in Manly. So that's kind of how it all came about. There are a fair few Tongans along the beaches, and that's why, because Manly Hospital, it used to exist, there was like a huge influx of women that came to learn nursing. So that's kind of how we got here. But I didn't really know the full, I didn't really get it. You know, I knew we looked different, but when you're walking around, you don't see you in the pack of people. You're just living, you know? I definitely get it now and I think, far out, how did my mum do it? But yeah.
With the scene, was it something that was just natural? And as you said before, you didn't realise you had that talent?
I wouldn't shut up around the house. Like I was singing, I was dancing. It was just in me. And I know people say that and you don't really get it, but like I said, my brother was a surfer. My mum was actually really into tennis and she used to teach on the beaches. Nobody wanted it as a career. Obviously, being Tongan, I grew up singing in church. Everyone can sing. But for me, it was just in me. Like I was doing dancing, singing, acting from the age of like 4, I reckon. And I was doing all the like performing at the local, like a Warriewood Square and then Warringah Mall. That was big time, going to the mall. But yeah, it was just in me. I know it sounds really cliche, but it's true. I just had to kind of get it out. And it was very obvious when you're around people who don't do it, you kind of strive for it even more. And then my mum changed me from the local high school and said, you're going to an all-girls private school. Because she knew if I went to a local school, it wouldn't have been good. So I went to an all-girls school and there was no music. I would have rather go to like performing arts, but mum was like, nah, you're going to concentrate on your education, which was good in the end because it made me fight for what I wanted and it made me realize it's really all I wanted to do was sing. And that's all I did when I left school. I was like, awesome. All right, I did what you wanted me to do. Now I'm going to go do what I want.
So what did your mum think when she was taking you at 14, she was taking you to the, you know, to sing and everything, and what was she thinking then?
Well, you got to remember my mum's first gen. So my mum grew up in Tonga in this tiny island. So she was like, she was probably in the club. Like, don't get me wrong, my mum was hot back then. I reckon they're looking at her and just like, what do you got her for? So my mum was really, it's one of the things about being first generations, when you're doing something, your parents are doing it for the first time too, which is really cool. So she was on the journey with me, you know, and she just supported me. I think about it, I'm like, far out. How did she do it? How did she afford it? I think we all do that when we look back and look at our parents and go, how did they make it all happen?
So from there, when did you get the big break that you knew that this was going to be the career that you're going to continue with?
So after I left school, I auditioned for a musical called Rent and I got it. I don't know how. I was really, really young. It's like my first year out of school. I was studying performing arts and my job was basically to understudy Kristi Naanu. And that was like in the 90s when she was like, you know, everything. She was huge. And for me, being a young Polynesian woman, she was everything. I was like, that was the most famous islander I'd ever seen or known, you know? So understudying her was huge. And it was like Roger Corsa, as you know, like Dr. Doctor, he was the other lead. There was Nat Bass was in the show, a guy called Matt Lee, who's gone on to do huge things. It was just this really special cast and a big musical that came from Broadway, that the people from New York, they came here to cast the show. So it was a huge deal. It was almost like the first rock musical. Before that, it was just musical like Cats, like all these kind of boring musicals that, like the traditional ones. And this show was like the first time they were getting like young singers who weren't necessarily musical theater. They were getting, you know, the likes of Christine, myself, Pop, Roger Corso at the time, he was just a pub singer. And this is actually, that was his first big thing too. And they were really like changing what musical theater was. And that was before like We Will Rock You and shows like that. So it was, we were kind of on the, we were one of the first ones to shake up what musical theater is now, you know, things like Hamilton and all these shows that are a bit of rock, bit of hip hop, bit of all these different things. So that was my first big kind of breakout. And yeah, and then from there, I just did musical theater. Then I moved to America and got signed over there for a while. And then I guess my next big thing when I came back from America was The Voice. And they would probably be the two big things, you know, being on The Voice, finally getting to do and sing what I wanted to do, singing against my best mate, Mahalia Barnes, who just happened to be Jimmy Barnes's daughter. Like, that was huge, you know? And like, we still laugh about it that I beat her, kicked her butt. And that was back when TV was like, TV wasn't competing with Netflix and stuff like that. We had something like 4 million people watch our battle when we sang against each other. Those numbers are just unheard of now, now that we can, you know, pick up our phone and go, we want to watch this now. It was kind of at the end of TV, not the end of TV, but moving, you know what I mean, moving out of that stage of, you know, if you want to see it, you've got to tune in at 7 o'clock on a Monday. You couldn't, it's not so easy and accessible like it is now. So, yeah.
Yeah, very similar to like Bondi Rescue is the same. It used to do massive numbers pre, you know, as you said, all the digital channels, Netflix and everything else has come along now.
Yeah, it's changed everything, you know. I think it's for the good and I also think it's for the worse as well. It's like it's a bit of both and I think we see it in our kids the most. Everything is instant. They want everything straight away. It's like far out. It's just a different world, you know.
Yeah, it definitely is. Now, with The Voice – and when you go into to sing or dance, is there a percentage of nerves that come in when you go to do something like that?
I was crap. Like I watched the like my blind audition. I'm like, oh my gosh, because it's so nerve wracking. And you got to remember when I did The Voice the first time, because I did it twice, but nobody knew what it was. Like it'd never been, nobody knew what these chairs turning was going to be. And I think that's why it was so successful. But like you stand there and you're like, literally my whole career is banking on this one moment. And I've proven that I don't do amazing in those situations. Once I get in and I'm comfortable, I can sing well and all those sorts of things. But I think also being like Islander and we're brought up in these big families where I felt the weight of my whole family. That's just the way we're brought up. You know, it's not just you standing there. It's you, your mum, your mum's family, your dad, everybody, all your cousins, all the people back in Tonga. It's a lot of weight. Obviously, over the years, I've gotten better at it, but it's bloody scary. Like, and especially if you take what you've done very seriously, I think in those moments, ignorance is bliss. I see a lot of the younger ones that go out and just go, ah, whatever. Ignorance is bliss in that moment that you're not overthinking it. But when you get older and you're like, man, like, what have I just done? My whole career's on the line if you mess this up and all the things. But I've definitely overcome them. I can do live TV now and not freak out as much. But it's really hard. It's so hard.
So what about when you're up there singing and you're trying to sing the song, stay in tune, but you'd be watching the chairs and going, just turn around.
It's funny because I don't know if it probably happens with other people in their own careers, but there's like that voice that you're going, I'm thinking about that probably, like, okay, because I remember for me they turned late. Well, the one I wanted, Joel Madden, and that turned really, really late. Seal turned really quickly, and I was like, ugh. Seal gives me the creeps, still does to this day. I don't know why. Everyone was like, anyway, but I do remember thinking all the different things, like, oh, I want the chairs to turn, oh, this, oh, I'm not singing in tune, oh, but the only way you can get through those moments is not listening to those voices, and you're just like, stop listening. What are you doing? You're not concentrating. You've got to get out of it. But that's years and years of practice and also just doing the work. Doing the hard work on yourself and learning to not listen to that inner saboteur that's going, you know, all the negative thoughts, you know, it's just being able to get rid of them.
And then you did say you came back for a second time. What was that?
So I came back, I got asked back to be one of the first All-Stars. Actually, I was the very first All-Star, which came with a bit of slack because a lot of people were saying, well, all these guys have already had their chance. Why are you bringing them back? And my nerves were even worse the second time. Like, you'd think I'd learn, right? And I was just standing there going, far out. Well, what I actually thought, because I was the first one, I was like, this would be more exciting if the chairs didn't turn than if they did. You know, so I was, and you're always thinking about producers and how they're going to set you up and what they're going to do. And I just remember, far out, you're an idiot. Like, if it would look better if they didn't turn, you know, but they did. And again, did it for, I think that was season 9 that I did. And yeah, I came back as an All-Star, had 2 kids by that point, had my little baby Hope with me. She was only 3 months old, which was crazy when I think back to that. And yeah, did it all over again.
Did you take anything away from both those times? Do you think you got any experience from going on The Voice?
100%. I'm a better performer because of it. Mainly probably the first one, because I was on longer, so I learnt more. Just learning that, like, live TV, how to be able to perform to a small camera where you're like, there are millions of people down that barrel, but also there's a room full of people as well. So you have to learn to perform to the audience that's within the room, but then also learning, and you probably had this too, like, it's one thing to talk to a room full of people. It's another thing to look down a lens and talk to millions and millions of people, not overthink it, not put it on, to be your authentic self. It's a really weird, television's a really weird medium to be able to, like, not put it on and go, hello guys, here I am. You know what I mean? And just being like normal, but also going, okay, there's a lot of people on the other end of that lens. You got to get everything across and share your story or whatever you're trying to do. And for me, I really wanted to be a voice for young Polynesian kids, girls or boys or whatever. Like I said, when I was growing up, there wasn't many, and I just knew I wanted to be like a positive representative of who I was or my family, and yeah, no pressure.
Well, you also went on and did Bodyguard. Tell us about that.
Far out. Yeah, so that, I guess, comes along with the audition thing as well, which I think is why I was so comfortable doing those auditions on The Voice, because I've been auditioning for musicals my whole career, since I was like 10. And The Bodyguard was probably the most intense audition I've ever done. It was 3 months. It was myself and Paulini, back and forth, going for that lead role for the Whitney Houston role. The role of a lifetime. And my agent just kept saying, there's an Australian team and an English team. So similar to the Rent that I did before, the English team were the ones who, like, owned the rights, were bringing the show out, they were coming to teach us and all those sorts of things. So the Aussie team wanted one of us and the English team wanted another, like the other one, so either me or Paulini. I never found out which one. It doesn't actually matter. So they had us singing all the same songs. They flew us. We did a few here in Sydney. They even flew us to Adelaide, where we did more auditions literally went for 3 months. And then I remember finally getting the call and they offered me the sister. And I remember being very honored anyway. I guess it's a lot to do with my upbringing, but there was only two roles. You know, it's such a huge show. My ego obviously was like, okay, you didn't get that role. It was a little hurt, but I never forget a good friend of mine when I said, what do I do? Because what they had done was they asked me to play the sister, but they also asked me to play the Whitney role twice a week as well. So I kind of got the best of both worlds, I guess. And I remember one of my really good friends who's very experienced in musical theatre, she said, what I would advise you to do, which I kind of already had thought, she goes, what you do is you take the role of the sister, you gracefully accept it, you play the best sister that's ever been played, you play the best role you've ever done, but in order to do that, you're probably going to have to walk away from doing the other one because you're going to be doing two things at the same time. And the only one who's going to suffer is you. So sometimes you just got to make choices for yourself, like smart decisions. And it was probably one of the best decisions I ever made. Playing the sister in The Bodyguard was probably my favorite role I've ever played. I loved it. I loved singing next to Pauline every day. She's one of my closest mates now. She was incredible as Whitney. And yeah, I learned a really big lesson in like just do what you can and don't try to overperform for what other people want. Just deliver at the best capabilities you can and don't like try to make everybody happy all the time. You know what I mean? Because I would have been, that would have been too much, you know, and let her have it, like let her be amazing. And I just felt like that comparison of me and her going back and forth for 3 months, I almost wanted that to end and just gracefully take my role and go, you know what, I'm actually really happy with this. Let's just do that and bring somebody in to like understudy the two roles. And it just felt like they were trying to pit us against each other, you know. But yeah, it was awesome. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
And that can be hard too when it's competition. You can really it could go the other way very easy, couldn't it?
Absolutely. And I'm way too competitive. And also at that time, I'd done like 10 years of musical theatre, whereas that was Paulini's very first show. So there was almost more pressure on me to play that role. Not better, but there was more pressure on me overall, whereas that was her first show. There wasn't as much pressure on her. So I was just like, nah, just let the competition be done for now and just enjoy it. So, yeah.
And you also did other ones as well. Hair, was that another one that you did?
Yeah, that's a funny story, actually. So Paulini, you know, there's the famous, like, Marsha role. That's how she came to Australia. She was pregnant with Denny at the time. Very famous for singing the Age of Aquarius big song in Hair. That's how Marsha came here. So that's the role that, you know, I would think that I would go for. So Hugh Sheridan had been announced and Paulini had been announced for doing Hair, the musical. And then they were going on to find the rest of the roles and fill everything in. So my agent calls me and he was like, so Hair want to see you. And I was like, yeah, cool, tell them to get stuffed. And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, I know that like the role that I would go for has already been filled. I don't want to understudy. I don't want to like play a smaller role. I'd rather just kind of concentrate on what I'm doing at the moment. He was like, no. And I was like, what? And he goes, no, the lead role, Sheila, the girl who plays opposite Hugh Sheridan, they haven't been able to find anyone who can kind of like, Hugh Sheridan has a huge personality. He's a really like out there guy. He's full on, like he's like a big kid. And they just couldn't find anyone who could match his energy. But also you had to kind of dominate him a little bit in that the role of Sheila was the, because, you know, they were fighting against the war and about people being sent, all the men being sent off to war. And she was like one of the main protesters and the main people within their group that was fighting for their rights. And they just couldn't find a woman strong enough to kind of be that person, stand up against him, be able to like kind of wrangle him a little as well. So I went in and did the audition, probably half of it. I swear it was my worst audition I've ever done in my life because I didn't know the songs. I was like, well, I know the other chick songs, like, but I've never even listened to this girl's songs. I was awful. I sang, and what happened was they called me and they wanted to see me the next day. And I was at a gig, I remember, out in Homebush going, guys, I don't even have the time to learn the song. Like, if you want to see me tomorrow, that's cool. But I literally have a gig until like midnight tonight. Anyway, yeah, rocked up. I was awful. I was like making up some weird melody. I was probably singing happy birthday to the lyrics of the song. But I think it was more so the acting and the scenes that I did with Hugh that worked. I mean, to be fair, they know I can sing and that I could learn a song. But, yeah, I ended up playing the lead role of Sheila, which was, again, one of my favorite roles to ever play, and just such a moving story with you know, all the young men in the 70s being sent off to war. And actually my grandfather, my dad's dad, was, you know, he was sent off to, he lived that life and came home after war and was never the same, you know. So a lot of us have lived through that. I know a lot of families even here after World War II, and a lot of Aussies were sent off. So, yeah, and to think we're back in a war now is just crazy.
Yeah,
it is. I loved that show. Loved it.
So do you think it must be great having the talent to sing, but also you tell the story through music. That must be amazing.
That's the best bit. And that's why I think I've, like, lasted the – you know, the test of time with being able to perform and keep performing. Like, I think if you're not telling a story, there's a difference between an artist, well, a singer and an artist. A singer just sings a song, whereas an artist will tell the story and move people and sing the song to be able to tell the story. The song's just the vehicle, you know. The stories are, that's where the good bit is. And moving people and changing people's life, or letting them walk away and think about something, or maybe change their thought on something, or maybe, you know, deal with something in their life that they're not dealing with. It's like music is so powerful, you know. It's a big ask. So, yeah.
Well, that brings me to, and I came and saw you with the Lady Sings the Blues, and it's an amazing show. So tell us about how that came about.
So, I mean, it sounds like everybody, but during COVID, that's kind of how it all came about. Lady Sings the Blues is a show that I wrote about all the influences that I've had growing up here in Australia. It's about, I de-Americanized the whole show in the end, like, you know, and I feel like Australia is almost, we're de-Americanizing ourselves. I feel like we looked at America for so long, thinking we wanted to be like them. I myself, being a soul R&B singer, thought I wanted to be like them. Went over to America, got signed to Sony, and then realized, you know, maybe that's not really what I want. And maybe that's not really who I am, which is what inspired the show and inspired me to tell the story of all the famous American women that influenced me, but also to come home and rewrite the story for myself. As you know, I do a rendition of My Island Home where I kind of turn the whole story around and go, well, nah, this is our story, you know? And it is. It's like, it's the story of women struggling just in life. I talk about the Indigenous women that, you know, lost so many women and like the Stolen Generation, but also just all of the women everywhere, whatever or whoever your ancestors are, like even hair, all these different stories of all the people who sacrificed so much, and that's what the show's about. And it's pretty full on, but it's all about storytelling. Like you said, I'm not just singing a few songs. Everything has a pretty strong story to go with it. It's draining, it's fun, but it's like it's everything I've learnt over my career jam-packed into like an hour, which is also why now Sydney Festival have just picked up Lady Sings the Blues Volume 2. So I'm going to go on to talk about more women, talk about more Australian women, and I just think this story is like endless. There's so many singers, so many great singers, so many great stories just to be told to Australian audiences. And I think, like, I feel like our history is so young. I just think we've been so influenced by so many other countries and just so much. And we're such a young country that we're creating our own story now. And I think it's really exciting. And I think it's exciting to not constantly look at America to influence us, or England, or anywhere. Now it's time to kind of write our own stories. So that's what I'm trying to do here, and, you know, try to employ great musicians and hopefully encourage my girls as well, and just younger performers, to not always look to other people and other places to get inspiration. Like, it's right here. We can do it for ourselves. We don't need anyone.
And you can learn a lot through music, can't you? Like, as you said, you get to learn the stories as well as listening to the music, and it's something that I think the younger generation can take hold of, because they don't know what the history has been.
No, totally. And it's music is so accessible, you know, like a lot of people come to my shows and then go, oh, I never really listened to Billie Holiday. Oh, I never really listened to Ella Fitzgerald, or especially these younger kids. Like, Spotify is their best friend, and it has absolutely everything in there. It's a history lesson on its own. You just have to flick and find it all. But I'm here to kind of inspire people to go back and learn from what was before. But also, I do 100 years of music in the show. I call it Billy to Beyonce. So it's like, you know, all the way back 100 years, all the way to now, and nothing has really changed. Music's still saying and doing the same thing. It's just like, what do you choose to listen to, and what do you choose to be influenced by? So, yeah.
Who was your biggest influence when you were coming through? You know, singing your songs, and who did you really look up to?
I loved Whitney Houston, still do. I always wanted to be Janet Jackson, still do. Yeah, they're probably the main two when I was growing up. The singer dancer, Whitney was just like, it's the gospel thing as well. I grew up singing in church. Whitney Houston was just like absolutely mind blowing for me, and watching her career was just heartbreaking for me. I even tell the story in my show about how she came to Hunter Valley towards the end of her career, and my younger brother was like, we've got to go. I didn't end up going. I just couldn't. I think I probably just sit there and cry the whole time. I think it was so hard to watch a woman like that just end up having no voice at all. I think fame can be a really crazy thing. I've been lucky in my career that, like, I've been successful, but I haven't had fame in my life to kind of change too much. You know, I feel like I've had a happy medium of being recognized for what I do, but not being in a position where I'm expected to do or change my life, or it's probably by choice as well. I think there's like a happy medium of being a musician and being happy, and then being thrown into the world and being expected to be perfect, because I'm sure as hell I'm not perfect.
And, I mean, you would have seen a lot of musicians through their career, and a lot of people fall off the rails. And as you said, I mean, at Whitney Houston's level, trying to be perfect all the time and probably worried about what people think, it must be pretty stressful.
Yeah, and I think that's why a lot of them turn to drugs, abusive behavior. And, you know, when you're singing in front of 100,000 people and then going home to an empty room, or when you're selling millions and millions of records and you're the biggest, you can only go down, you know? And these people and these, that I even see it with Jimmy Barnes, you know, like, and I've been really lucky enough to be so close with the family and just seen his incredible journey. And I don't know if anybody's seen his, Working Class Boy. And if you get the chance, see the show, read the books, like, he is the epitome of what fame and fortune can get you. And he's worked really hard to be able to find a good balance. These people are exposed to a lot, and they're given so much. They're given copious amounts of money and drugs and alcohol and women and or men or whatever it is. It's like everything all at once. And then they're expected to be able to deal with it all rationally when everything they've been given is irrational. You know what I mean? It's like Michael Jackson. All these people that are like, how can you, of course they're crazy. Like, what do you expect? And I think it takes a little bit of crazy to make extraordinary people like that.
When you do a show, and as you said, you'd be on such a high performing in front of a crowd, when it's done later on, I mean, how hard is it to go to sleep? Are you still on that massive high?
I don't sleep. Like, my whole family's in bed. I think having a family helps because they bring you back down to reality, as I'm sure you know with your own daughters. And also, really for me, like, even driving home and coming back to the beaches, and anybody who understands nature, I live in a place where I'm like right near the beach and right near the lake. So just having, even when I get home and I get past a certain point, even just smelling the sea breeze and just getting home, you're like, okay, cool. I may come home and have a glass of wine, but like, there's something about decompressing and being around nature for me that really, really helps. But yeah, I don't sleep. After a show, it's really hard to unwind.
Yeah. Well, it must do, because you finish late at night with the concert, and then obviously you just got to try and switch off, which is very, very difficult.
Yeah. I usually come home and watch some like Drag Race or some kind of like reality TV that just numbs my brain. But I'm so used to it now. I've been doing it for so long. I have my little routines, like magnesium, you know, things like that. My family know. Oh, Mum will be out front in the living room for a while. I probably won't go to bed until 1 or 2 in the morning. But it becomes your life, you know. And I've been lucky enough that I haven't had to turn to anything. I mean, I definitely had my time when I was younger, when you're singing and dancing and you're offered all the things, you know. I've definitely been around it. But I think growing up so young in the industry, I saw it all. I saw it all so young that nothing was like a surprise to me. So I was like, ah, and I've always been good at like doing things at a good rate, yeah. Never overdoing it. Yeah.
So what's the future? What's coming up next year? You got any big things coming up?
So 2024 is already pretty jam-packed. January is Sydney Festival, Lady Sings the Blues Volume 2. And then I always go to Adelaide for Fringe Festival, which will be Lady Sings the Blues Volume 2. Taking Lady Sings the Blues to Perth, which I'm so excited about, to the Fringe Festival in February. And then I've just booked a whole national tour going to Byron, Coffs, Queensland, Melbourne, Sydney, Adelaide, Perth, everywhere. So full national tour all over the country of Lady Sings the Blues. And then, after that, who knows?
Amazing, amazing career. When you look back, do you think that I can't believe what I've achieved?
Totally. coming from a family that nobody sang, I very much forged my own path. And yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy being a young Islander kid from the Northern Beaches, but I'm pretty full on about always coming back and, you know, paying tribute to the people who helped me get here. And I think what I'm probably most proud about is just working through all the crap we all have. And music's been able, has been my therapy. It's a lot cheaper. been my therapy to like work through all the things that happened to me as a kid. We all had stuff, you know, and the main thing is to not pass it on to the next gen. Like the whole aim is so that they're better than we are, you know. And I have my eldest is in America and off doing her own thing. And, you know, at 17, I had left and was already doing my career. So the aim is for the next gen to do better than me. So as proud as I am of my career and what I've done, it's not so much about me anymore. Shock, horror. yeah, it's all about them. But in saying that, the more doors I beat down, the less fear they'll have, the more brave they'll be. So I'll continue to do it, continue to kind of wave the flag for all the things I represent. But yeah, it's pretty cool looking back on all the crazy things I've done here in Australia and America and even London when it did the West End for a little bit as well. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Have you ever spoken to your mum about those times at 14 when she was taking you to, you know, the concerts and performing and now how proud she must be on where you've got to today?
My mother is another level of crazy, and she tells me every day in her actions. I think coming from the islands, like my grandmother literally lived in a hut. As far as she could reach was as big as it was. So, and you know, we travel back all the time. We're going, you know, next month for family reunion. She doesn't say it, but you're right. I should sit down and talk to her about it. But thinking about how far we've come, how far she's come, and it's just every generation just keeps furthering more forward every single year. And, yeah, I think you've inspired me to sit down with her and yeah, just ask her about those times. It's funny. She used to, like, set me up. I remember there was New Year's Eve. I sang at the at the basement, huge deal. It's like, I think it was 99. And she bought me this green, beautiful green dress. And I was like, did my whole outfit, was singing on stage. My mum rocks up late, New Year's Eve, packed basement. I was like living my best life. My mum walks in with the same green dress. She set me up. And to be fair, back then, I think Mum looked better than I did. My mum looked good. So to say she's proud, like I said, she shows it every day. She set me up.
That's a classic, absolute. Well, Pretty, it's great hearing your story. You know, you've got plenty more to come, I'm sure, in years to come. So congratulations on your career. It's been great. I've seen a lot of stuff. You even sang at our wedding with myself and Karen. So that was a privilege to have you there singing.
I don't do it for everyone, Hopper, so I actually never sing at weddings, but of course, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, I feel very privileged for that.
It was a great day. But, yeah, it's nice reflecting on these things. A lot of times you're just kind of so busy doing life, you forget to look back on it. So thanks for having me.
That's great. Now, at the end of the interview, I do a segment, 5 fun facts. So I'm going to throw some questions at you and answer them however you like. The first one is, what are the best and worst purchases you've ever made?
Best purchase I ever made, my car, because it gets me out of Dodge every single time. The worst purchase I ever made was probably every piece of jewelry I've ever, like, I just lose everything. I lose all my jewelry. This will be gone. This will be gone very, very soon.
Cats or dogs, and why?
I'm not an animal person. I can't be trusted with a cat or a dog. Children, yes. Animals, no.
What are you most proud of?
Most proud of my girls, definitely.
What's the most interesting thing you've read or seen this week?
The most interesting would have to be this back and forth with Palestine. I'm one of those people, I don't want to influence people with my opinion. All I want to do is just read up. So I'll continue to read up on this situation, and hopefully there'll be some peace for everybody very, very soon.
What song do you have to sing along with when you hear it?
This is my guilty pleasure. Horses by Daryl Braithwaite. Every time. I can't help it.
That's a great song. I love that song too. All right, Pretty, thanks for coming to the Beach Shack. It's been a pleasure having you, and we'll catch up soon.
Yes, please. Thanks, Hoppo.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Now let's go to Beach Banner. For this week in the Beach Shack, we've got Jacko. He's returned again. A lot of the lifeguards do other jobs outside of being a lifeguard. And I noticed that you have now started in doing something else. Give us a bit of an insight on what that is.
Yeah, so recently probably going back 12 months now, I sort of was just talking to Maxie about some of the work he does. As we all know, that he's a firefighter, and he's a pretty inspiring guy, Maxie. He also works on the Navy ships as a rescue technician. And I was sort of just picking his brain one day at work and talking about some of the roles they do and what it involves. And it's quite interesting. So pretty much the company that he works for now, we oversee all the high risk work on the Navy ships, because there's a big Navy base in Woolloomooloo in Sydney here, where a lot of the ships are, well, all of the ships are based out of. We write up the rescue plans, because there is lots of high risk work that happens on these ships. And we're then trained with confined space rescue gas. We got to test the gas atmospheres and issue the work permits before this high risk work can happen. And a lot of that, you know, it contains like a lot of rope rescues and winching, and it's a whole new world out there. But at the same time, it's rescue. It's similar to the stuff on the beach, but at the same time, totally different. So I just sort of dipped my toe into that sort of side of things and thought, you know, another source of income, you know, add some more strings to the bow and just get amongst that emergency care, because that sort of feel like I was put in this world to do. And I've been there 12 months now, and the company have put me through a lot of tickets and have a lot more qualifications next to my name now that I can use in the big scary world out there. So it's been great, and working at Garden Island on these huge Navy ships has been a super cool experience.
It's always good doing something outside of being a lifeguard, because it's great being down there at the beach, but you know, you can get a bit stale as well if you're not doing something to stimulate yourself, and also to get these extra tickets, it's a good achievement as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we do a lot of, like, the shifts on the beach are 12 hours long in the middle of summer. And so if you work longer days, it's like any shift, you get more days off. And I found that I had a fair bit of spare time, and I thought, why not you know, use the time wisely. We're not here long, and to learn some new skills. So I'm a long way into that now and really enjoying my time. And it's also, I think it's super healthy, just meeting other people, going into new workplaces and just surrounding yourself in new areas and new experiences. So it's all been great and a learning experience, and feel like I'm a rookie again. But it's, you know, we've all got to start somewhere, and it's certainly somewhere that I'm enjoying, something I'm enjoying.
Yeah, and the learning's good because you can take some of the lifeguard experience to there, but then you'll gain experience there that you can also bring back to lifeguards.
That's exactly right. I remember when I first got on there and the boss sort of said, you know, what experience do you have? And I mentioned that I've been a lifeguard for, you know, nearly about 10 years. And he was chuffed. He said, look, we don't have much first aid experience down here. And I said, mate, I've been involved in, you know, lots of first aid and lots of big incidents down the beach. And I'd love to be able to bring my sort of tricks of the trade and share those with some of the team down here. And, you know, sort of you scratch my back, I scratch your back kind of thing. And you can put them together and all of a sudden you've got a really, really strong team and strong set of skills.
And it's strange though too, isn't it? The other organisations, I found when I've gone and done stuff, that it seems that the safety first aid side of things is like the last that they think about, and then they go from there.
Isn't it funny? I found the same thing. I was doing a course last week actually, and it was a confined space rescue course, and 3/4 of the course was on extracting, you know, people out of confined spaces, which is obviously what it's around. But I found about 1/4 of the course, and it was back ended, was to do with the first aid. And I was thinking to myself as this was going, so, you know, we're going to get the guy out, but what if he's got crippling injuries where we can't move the guy? Who's going to provide the critical care? It was a bit mind boggling. So it's good to know that, you know, if I am put in a situation when I am in that job, that I have the experience and tools to really be able to help and put my hand up and say, look, I can take this on board. And a guy who may be up the top winching us out, he's been doing that for years with rope work and knots and stuff that I'm not privy to. So, you know, it's good.
Mate, Jacko, thanks for coming in, and well done with getting into doing some safety work outside of being a lifeguard.
Thanks, Hoppo.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Remember to subscribe to Life's a Beach wherever you get your podcasts, and hit us up with questions, comments, or follow us on our social media channels, which you can find in our show notes. That's it for today, beach fans. Stay safe and swim between the flags.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of 1. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing Board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.